Recording has recommenced.
All right, so it's mine. Welcome to ITE 1, Module 4 for Semester 1 of 2011. And this will certainly be a single part because this is a rather short chapter. If there are no questions pertaining to anything, we will go ahead and launch right into it. Okay, Module 4 is on preventive maintenance and troubleshooting. And these are things you look at and you go, oh Lord, but they're actually quite good, or quite useful. So, you know, the inward groans should be going away by now. Preventive maintenance reduces the probability of hardware or software problems by systematically and periodically checking hardware and software to ensure proper operation. So we just make sure things are working as they should be. And have you ever known people who won't get their car looked at until there's something really goes wrong with it? It starts making horrible noises or just, you know, not acting as it should, and they really ought to have looked at it far before now.
Just from a help desk perspective.
With your computer.
Just from a help desk perspective, you get these people ringing you up on the help desk, complaining to you bitterly about how their computer has died this morning, and their presentation is due in this morning. And why isn't their computer due in this morning? Have you done any of the preventative maintenance? That's irrelevant. My computer should work this morning. So you will experience these people in IT land who will not get their computers maintained, which Sean's just about to tell you, you know, exactly how to do, and they wonder why things stop working. What's that silly acronym we used to have? Is that in this chapter still? The prevents trouble-free operation or something? Have we still got that in here?
Nope. No, that's a printer thing.
No.
That's the printing process.
That's constant care will delay trouble forever is the printer thing. Yeah. That's,
well, it's true for this,
which
too.
Which I also get to do. Yeah, it is. You're absolutely right, it is. And I need to take more constant care of my computers.
Yeah.
No,
guys...
That.
When this happens, when you have the irate customer on the phone, don't tell them how they should do their preventive maintenance right then. Fix their computer first and try not to laugh at these poor people. They really are upset.
And we did actually, there is a portion of the chapter, and I'm not sure if it's in here, but we'll go over it. I actually laughed when I said, conversation etiquette, and I kind of went, oh my, they went there. But
hey,
if
some people
not in
need
my
it.
Notes, we'll go there. You're right. So if it's not in the notes, we'll
it's
go in
an
there
and
I'll try
part
and figure
of being
out where
tech.
It fits. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, you know, picking up the phone and going, ugh, so you've lost your data, you loser, is not going to win you any friends, and you're probably
so
not going to retain
beat
your job.
You. I could help you,
well,
but...
We might as well go over it now since we're talking about it. You don't insult the customer, you don't use technical jargon with the customer, you don't want to accuse them of causing the problem, even if it is their fault, and sometimes it is.
It beats me, Drew.
You don't want to have them feel that it's their fault, you know, because that doesn't make them feel good. So those
even
are
if it is.
Basic things, too.
Yeah, even if it is, don't make them feel that way. Because once people get angry and upset... And stressed, they then become far less able to follow your directions and instructions. So the idea is to keep them as calm as possible until you get all of their problems fixed, and then you go and rant about them in privacy with the rest of your help desk staff afterwards as a de-stress.
Or you just laugh uproariously if you have to, but you don't give that long. If you get Daphne calling in, you have to, and she'll probably make a return.
Oh, she will. Somebody will have to stay cool.
We have to figure out how.
I know who's getting her. But one of you will be lucky enough
to
have to stay calm
what's going on.
In the face of absolute crazy.
Yeah, pretty much.
Anyone got comments on phone etiquette and that sort of stuff? Anything they want to share apart from know where the mute button is on your phone?
Yeah, that's important.
Yeah, mute buttons are very good.
That
to know.
Could actually and be more difficult with these phones with soft keys.
Calm, even, measured breath.
Speak calmly.
And when you talk to
Twitter
customers,
is great therapy.
You gotta be careful with that.
You ensure that customers you blame it on ignorance, not the customer. Oh, you didn't know about that? Okay, well, this is what you do.
I wouldn't even say that.
I wouldn't even go there, no.
If they say, I didn't know, no. That's when you agree with them and go, oh, you didn't know? Okay, well, this is what we have to do. You don't excuse them of not knowing, but if they actually sort of put their hand up and throw the ignorance card, you just sort of smile along and go,
oh, I didn't
know.
That's okay.
I think why people get
angry... Yeah, it's fine, it's giving me a job.
I think the reason why people get the
and the outsourced tech support that you get when you call your ISP is not a good example.
That's why you pick a good ISP, like IINet, that still
I've
has people
had
in Australia.
Good.
Woohoo!
I've actually had good outsourced tech support. I think some of them try harder because they get so much flack. At least that's what I've found anyway. But, I mean, that's just me.
Brad, it's your turn. Go.
I'm kind of from the company.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think the reason why a lot of people, you know, they get upset is because they're just fearful of their current situation. If you can just assure them that you're going to get them through it, and I think they'll calm down a lot more, but they just need to have that assurance that they got help, you know, so.
Absolutely. And anybody who's ever been in Australia and tried calling TPG tech support, have fun with that. I'm not sure which developing country their call center is in, but if you can't tell them whether the red light is blinking on the modem, they're probably unlikely to help you. So it can be quite challenging for the customer to call these outsourced places depending
on... I've actually heard someone be
I've
asked,
had that.
They said, oh, well, I'm
I've
blind, I can't see the light. Oh,
people.
What does that mean?
What does that mean? What do you think it means? One thing I want to say, and we would not realize this because we're blind, and some people think that because we're blind, we're special, but blind people are not the only people who can tell when people are not smiling or angry or stressed on the phone. Your sighted counterparts can do that just as well as we can, so do remember to keep smiling, keep speaking in a positive way, and don't clench your teeth and do this.
Yeah, that's something I've been working with someone recently, you know, oh crap, you can't do that on the phone, or oh,
welcome,
you know,
to the Acme Telco Corporation. How may I help you with the problem you're having today?
Wow.
Anyway, so preventive maintenance.
Wouldn't you
want
to talk to that guy?
If you
that didn't sound very guyish.
No, I was going to say
no,
that.
No, it
didn't. That.
So if this person that we're talking about, if they'd only gotten their car looked at or whatever, it would have saved them time, inconvenience, and money. And that's what we try to do with preventive maintenance. We try and make sure that we prevent problems before they happen, which is what the name says. So this is why we do this. Yes, this includes cleaning various components, replacing parts that are broken or worn out, etc. And explanations on which device should be cleaned and how to do that, we did cover in Chapter 2. I'll briefly go over some of them. The very last diagram in Chapter 2 is particularly awesome. So compressed air is often used to remove dust, and the soft, lint-free cloth is another thing that we use a lot, along with mild solution. Some of the tasks we do in hardware preventive maintenance include removing dust from fan intakes, and we wipe them out with a soft cloth. Remove dust from power supply, and you wipe the external vent of that with a soft cloth as well. Remove dust from components inside the computer, and we're going to use a can of compressed air very carefully. You can clean the mouse and keyboard by using a soft cloth with a mild solution or a special vacuum designed to be used on computer components. We don't want pieces of touchpad getting vacuumed up, as has happened to people we know of. The other thing we do is we check and secure any loose cable connections, and we are going to look for excess wear on components as well. I found some where I need to put a space in, so I'm just doing that. Software tasks that we can do for preventive maintenance include updating the operating system and programs. Do the Windows updates, guys. They fix important stuff. I know it sometimes it's like, oh, just get out of my way. Go away. I don't care about the Windows updates, but they are important. And that was one of the things when they said today at work, what kind of things do we need to make sure happen to the computers? I said, leave them on so they can do the virus checks and update them and I also need video driver update help, but that's another thing. That's just with that particular computer. Another thing we do is we defragment the hard drive, and there are various third-party programs to do that in Vista and 7, because my understanding is that the built-in defrag in Vista and 7 is not terribly great. Carrier,
that's
Grace,
right.
If you'd like to elaborate on that.
There's a really neat program called My Defrag, which will actually schedule your defragment. It's free. Yeah, it's free, and it's awesome.
However,
as long as you don't have a backup drive that it doesn't like.
Yeah, mine crashes if you've... I had Windows backup backing up onto a secondary hard drive, and every time the scheduled defragger would defrag that, it would blue screen my system, so watch out for that if you've got an external hard drive plugged in and it doesn't like to... doesn't tend to like it too much. But yeah, my defrag,
isn't
mydefrag.com.
Another one that we like?
Not as accessible. It's one of those C cleaner things where it's almost accessible except for the stuff that you've still got a review cursor. It's like 99% of it works really well, but some of the more advanced things like picking particular files and stuff can be problematic in Defragler.
Okay. We can also update...
Is one a better program than the other? Other than...
There's a stack of them. Go to thefreecountry.com.
No, I mean, is one a better program other than the other one?
JK Defrag is a... Oh, no, they're both different things. They're like, you know, chocolate and strawberry. My Defrag is a different philosophy to Defragler. Defragler is, I don't really want to know what's going on and I just want to make it go, whereas My Defrag is sort of more power. JK Defrag is actually the predecessor to My Defrag. It's actually been replaced by My Defrag. Because John Kessels decided that it was everybody's defragger, which is why he renamed it to My Defrag instead of JK for John Kessels.
Oh, but what about, in this way around, because I'm trying to remember the name of that absolutely horrible thing that people try and use for defragging that's ridiculously bloated for no good reason.
Diskkeeper?
Pay for. Yes, Diskkeeper, thank you.
Works exceedingly well, but it is very bloated, and it's quite expensive. Basically, most of the programs that do defragmentation simply call various bits of the Microsoft Defrag API. So, yeah, you can pay for defrag...
It has so much crap in your system, too. It's crazy.
Anyway, if you are confused, however, you can let the operating system take care of it and run the internal defraggers. We have better luck running things like MyDefrag. However, it is important, and I will mention this at this point...
The XP defrag is pretty good.
It's not bad, although it's going to wear your solid-state disk out faster than you can say, ooh, it wore my solid-state disk out, because it does shuffle a lot of things around. Don't defrag with the regular system defraggers on solid-state disks. If you must defrag a solid-state disk, and yes, it does make a difference, you want to use my defrag with the defragment solid-state disks option, which moves as little data as possible, but still defrags.
That's something I hadn't thought of, and that might have to go in... Well, no, I don't know if...
I thought I'd put that, did I?
No, I don't see it here.
Can you over defrag, you know, just a regular magnetic drive, you know, over...
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Do it too much?
Yeah. I mean,
so
you think
they
about
usually tell you when they need it. They usually can analyze it and say, hey, you probably should do it about now because there's a lot of stuff. Actually, I have a great analogy for defrag, for those who don't know what it is, and I came up with this when I did Chapter 12. If you're a really messy person and you get a new apartment and your new apartment is pristine and you think, oh, I'm going to be really good and I'm not going to leave food all over the place and I'm not going to throw things all over the floor and just find them as I need them, and you're great for a while, but then you're going to slip back into, if this is you, you're going to slip back into those old habits and more stuff is going to get just everywhere. And then defrag is sort of like your housekeeper coming in and sort of moving things around for you, except that you don't even have to really see them. But that's kind of how I thought of defrags. I thought, wait, not everybody's going to know what it is. We've got a fairly savvy group here at the minute, and so defrag makes a lot of sense to those of us who are on channel at the minute. But
has anyone ever heard the noises? Has anyone ever not heard the noises that a hard drive makes? You turn on the computer and you get... Right, well, the more you
some
get,
of them are
the slower things
almost.
Are going to go. Well, that's what the AM radio is for.
Some of them are almost... Yeah, yeah. Some of them are almost difficult to hear now.
However, the point I was going to make was that the more head movement your hard drive has to make, the slower it's going to pick things up, especially if you've got lots of temp files and you've been doing lots of audio editing and stuff. So you find these blindies who are doing internet broadcasting with their, you know, 300, you know, gigs of pirated MP3s spattered onto their C drive, and they haven't defragged since, like, the time before the first Christmas ever occurred, and then they wonder why their stream's breaking up and shuddering and shaking because they've never actually defragged. It's certainly worth defragging and tidying up defragging your drive. Look, it depends on what you're doing on the machine as to how often you should defrag.
I just go on another small rant and say that yes, Macs need defrag too, and if you really want to, I think there's a program called Disk Warrior. I don't know about its accessibility, but Macs need defragmented too, and we tend to forget that.
Yeah, they do.
Yes,
yeah, all file systems need some sort of defragmentation.
Nothing breaks in a Mac. If you put a hard drive into a Mac, then it will never fail.
He's being sarcastic. That's all right. We're used to this. The only thing I was going to finish off by saying was that depending on what you're doing on the machine, if you're doing lots of audio editing and stuff, you might want to defrag every week or two. Or if you're copying, you know, like 200 megs of stuff on and then deleting 100 megs and copying another, you know, gig of stuff on, or if your computer home hard drive is actually your TV cinema watching experience with a week's worth of movies that you've downloaded from the internet and are now watching your way through, and then you smash those away for the next week's worth of movies, you're going to get quite fragmented fairly quickly. But if you're not that sort of user, then
you wonder
maybe
how
once a month
the digital
or so.
Video recorders handle that.
They don't. They just have a big RAM buffer, as far as I can tell. The drives don't actually get defragged. It just sort of buffers in, like, you know, 64 meg of movie and just, yeah, just gets crunchier and crunchier as it goes, I suppose.
I just mean as you delete stall. Shows and...
That's a bad sign. I think that's the defragment equivalent of the maid looking at the house and being like, oh my god!
Yeah.
There's no way I'm going in there.
Yeah, pretty much.
Alright, moving on defrag if we can. Oh, nope, you still want to go. Okay.
No, that's what I was just going to say. I defragged a portable drive, and it crashed in the middle of it, and there was, like, full of, like, 2-second bits. It's just unrecoverable. So I was a little afraid to do some more defragging. Oh, my...
Okay.
That was...
Yeah, I was just gonna point out here, one of the things you've got to be careful about portable drives and stuff, and I'm just going to... Here comes Carrie's portable drive rant. We all have portable drives. And one of the big reasons why a lot of people have portable drives is because all of the stuff won't fit on their internal hard drive, so they'll chug it out onto this portable drive. Woohoo! I've now got infinite amounts more space. Now, this is not a backup, people. This is data relocation. And if you happen to be unfortunate, like a friend of mine who ran their office chair over their portable drive, all of the stuff you hoiked out onto that portable drive, which you didn't back up, is now gone. Okay? The other thing is, make sure that the connections and stuff to your portable drive are sturdy and reliable and stuff, because there's nothing worse than your portable drive going di-dink in the middle of a defrag and disappearing from the use of the system. You're going to have to check disk that and pray to your deity of choice that stuff is going to come back. The other thing you should know is that according to some survey, portable drives, when users use them, fail within 6 to 9 months of you purchasing them. Which is kind of good, because you can get a new one under warranty. But if there's a portable drive in your backpack, don't dump your backpack down with a thump loud enough to wake the dead, because all of those movies you just got off your mate are probably not going to be retrievable off your portable hard drive. So there you go. Go ahead, Sean.
Make sure that you're always aware where your portable hard drive is on your desk, and keep it out of an area that you're not likely to put stuff. Make sure you know where your cable is. A friend of mine who happens to be able to see managed to knock their portable hard drive off and lost a whole bunch. This was like a 1 terabyte drive and lost a whole bunch of stuff. Make sure you
we're
know
not
what
paying
it is and that you're not likely to...
Yeah, we're not paying out on you, Brad, because we feel very sad that you had this horrible trouble with your drive.
No,
we're just
really
trying to
do.
Alert everybody
no,
else
but
know
tell
that
everybody
these things
what
are dangerous.
No, I get that. No, I get that. I mean, I did exactly what you did. I didn't have enough space, and I didn't have the, you know, so I did use that as my major stored for music and audio bits and all that sort of stuff. And it did it just, when I defragged it, it just went, and then there was, you know, two-second bits of sound bites all over. It's just useless. So, I learned my lesson, and I learned it.
Yeah, seriously, guys, buy two portable drives. Like, save up the money and buy two of those 1 terabyte drives so that you do have a backup. Because there is nothing worse than seeing a user get themselves inebriated after they've lost their very, you know, carefully, you know, crafted music collection of a terabyte that just went f-tunk, f-tunk. It's very unpleasant to see people in that state. Especially over here where you can only download like 20 gig of it a month or something.
I need to...
Just out of curiosity, is there a defrag command for Linux? Because I've never seen one.
Yes, there are. It depends what file system you're running. XFS has a file system reorganizer, and there is actually a Python script that does do defragging on EXT3 and EXT4 file systems, and soon there will be an online defragger for EXT4. I'm not sure what file systems you're running, so I can't answer the question any more thoroughly than that. But you can catch me out of lecture, and we can talk about that if that's something that interests you.
Alrighty. Okay,
it's back to you, Sean. I'm ducking off. I will not interrupt you.
Yeah. Okay. Well, sometimes they're quite useful, actually. So, you know, it's not always a bad thing. We can run virus and spyware update and run spyware programs and virus programs, even if I can read. These types of tasks, and also troubleshooting as well, often must take place during times when a company is less busy or closed. So if you're working with an organization, you will need to schedule your preventive maintenance around their schedule. So you may have to work late or possibly on weekends, because these may be the only times this is possible in an organization. So like I said before, you need to try as a technician to inconvenience others as little as possible when you do your preventive maintenance. Do we have anything else we're going to talk about with preventive maintenance that people can think of, or shall we move on to the joys of troubleshooting next?
I have something I want to bring up with preventative maintenance. We did talk about hardware and software maintenance. You'll have a worksheet that asks you about these preventative maintenance steps and what you can do. Do look in the textbook and see what they have to say, because they want the stuff right out of the textbook. So this is basically the curriculum, yeah. So this is basically a look it up, find it, put it in, and there are some reflection questions and everything.
Yeah, it's actually quite good, and it's different from those that have been done in the past. It's fairly new. Are we going to have people...
Yes, everybody is doing that worksheet. Everybody. If you have been in the previous class and did the module for... No, not you. You're done. You're giving a lecture. Well, you don't have to do the worksheet again. If you are a student in this class, taking this class right now, you need to do this worksheet, whether you have done a preventative maintenance plan or not, because we found that a lot of people are having trouble with the troubleshooting process and remembering it. Trust me, when you're done with this worksheet, you'll have it down pat.
Another thing to point out is if you can't possibly remember it, it will be at the end of every single chapter, all the way to the end, because they just went boop and put it in. So don't think that chapter 4 is the last time you'll ever have to look at it if you pre-read, because you'll see it. Now, what I will say is that though they keep putting in the troubleshooting process after that, they tend to put in, let's say the chapter is on security, they put common problems and possible solutions in there. So those, even if you know the troubleshooting process forwards, backwards, and inside out, that little common problems and solutions table is often very fascinating and worth a read. I've found that as I was putting in the diagram descriptions for the text, I was like, you know, this stuff's really cool, and I wish I'd have picked... Well, I don't think they had it in the 4.0 as much as they do now. So, good stuff. Good stuff.
Has this worksheet for Chapter 4 been updated, like, since the beginning of the semester? Because that's when I had
Yes.
The, that's when I
yes,
got...
It has.
Okay.
So
yes.
Please re-download
so
your
I
zips.
I need to get a new one. Okay.
If you downloaded the graphical archives, it should be in there. Or the non-graphical ones, I'm sorry. If you've downloaded those, then the new worksheet should be in there, because I think at that time we had it. But, Grace, if you could check on that for me, that would be great.
Or check on which?
Check that. When we uploaded the non-graphical labs, make sure the Chapter 4 worksheet is the one. It will say A+ at the top as well, so it's
pretty
easy to...
It's there. We updated the zips.
Okay,
and
I couldn't
remember.
And
I'm pretty sure I actually announced that I had done that, but I maybe didn't. But yes, those zips are updated,
and
I will announce it again.
All right.
For anybody who wants to know how to tell whether the zip's been updated, look at the date and time next to the zip, and that will tell you. If it looks fairly recent and you think you got yours before then, grab another copy with a subnote that we're working on that slow download speeds at some point. So if anybody who keeps odd hours, I'm staring at you significantly, Drew, would like to help me benchmark things later on today, or somebody else who happens to keep odd hours, you could download a couple of things off the website when I tell you and we can figure out what's going on.
Absolutely not, but I probably...
Well, that was nice. Next, we're going to talk about troubleshooting process. Troubleshooting requires an organized and logical approach to problems with computers and other components. Let me reiterate that again. Troubleshooting requires an organized and logical approach. It's very easy to think you know what the solution is and sort of try and do it on your own, but I think you really do want to be logical about it, and I personally need to improve this in my own solving of problems, and I think we probably, even those of us who think we've done it for a while, probably could stand to do this. A logical approach to troubleshooting allows you to eliminate variables in a systematic order. Asking the right questions, testing the right hardware, and examining the right data helps you understand the problem. And this helps you form a proposed solution to try. So it just makes sure that you're prepared before you go in and start pressing buttons and flipping, you know, changing options and stuff. Make sure you have an idea of what you're doing and why. Troubleshooting is a skill that you will refine over time. Each time you solve another problem, you will increase your troubleshooting skills by gaining more experience. You will learn how and when to combine, as well as skip steps to reach a solution quickly. The troubleshooting process is a guideline that can be modified to fit your needs. This course, and this is just so, this is just a template. You don't have to use the whole thing. This course refers to a customer as anyone who needs technical assistance, regardless of whether they're an organization or that they're paying. The customer is whoever is getting technical help from you. And here are the steps to the troubleshooting process, it said new because at the time when Grace wrote this, it was new. It's not really new anymore, unless you've taken the older version of the course. Identify the problem. Establish a theory of probable causes. Determine an exact cause. Implement a solution. Verify solution and full system functionality. And document findings. And we're going to go over each of these in detail. Before you do any kind of troubleshooting, make sure the customer's data is backed up. Verify the following things with the customer about their backups. The date of the last backup, contents of the backup, data integrity of the backup, so is it good, or you know, do we have backups that have failed, in which case they're not going to be of use to anyone. Availability of all backup media verify the availability of backup media for a data restore, so make sure you know where it is. If the customer does not have a current backup and you are not able to create one, you should ask the customer to sign a liability release form. A liability release form should contain at least the following information: permission to work on the computer without a current backup, available release from or without a current backup available, release from liability if data is lost or corrupted, description of the work to be performed. So those are things that need to be on, ought to be on a release form. Because guess what? If you lose the company's data, you may be held responsible, and it may actually go to court. So make sure your bases are covered. Make sure you're, you know, protecting your reputation as a technician. Some tools that will help us do some troubleshooting a little more effectively. The Event Viewer is a tool that can be helpful in troubleshooting. This tool logs information about various errors, warnings, or behind-the-scenes information that is of use to technicians. In Event Viewer, not every problem or warning is cause for alarm. The computer's just keeping track of things, and some of which are just helpful or, depending on you, not helpful bits of information, whether you can interpret them. Event Viewer gives you the following information: what problem occurred, date and time of the problem, severity of the problem, source of the problem, event ID number, which user was logged in when the problem occurred. JAWS Tandem actually uses the Event Viewer to log when sessions start, stop, or are suspended. In case a technician wants to keep track of this information for billing and consulting purposes. I was at first a little creeped out by this until I went into the Event Viewer and saw how it worked, and realized that this really isn't a big deal. There is a fantastic lab in Chapter 5 on the Event Viewer, and I was like, oh, it's this is actually really geeky and cool.
Yeah, can I say something?
Neat.
I got
sure.
Sorry. I got disturbed. One of our another student of ours has gotten really, really sick. So I had to just write to them.
Oh.
What I was going to say is that backing up step is the official or the unofficial first step to the troubleshooting process that you do before you do anything, and that is a question on your worksheet. That is the first unofficial step, is the checking the backup, and if so, taking another backup.
Probably on the final as well.
No. It should be, but it isn't.
Really? Even on the new one?
No.
Yeah, it ought to be.
No. It should be. That is the unofficial first step. If your customer doesn't have a backup, take it and share it with them. Give them that backup. Here's your backup, if you can at all possible. All right, sorry.
However, it's often often backup is actually, if you're working as an independent contractor, backup is responsibility of the customer, not you. So if you have to back their stuff up, you can actually charge them for it. And believe me, on some times you need to.
A little bit more. Device Manager is another excellent tool which shows all of the devices configured on your computer. One way to quickly access Device Manager is to press the Windows key and the pause/break key. You can also use the properties option of the My Computer or computer icons. If you're on a laptop and you just don't know where Device Manager is, I think if you know the name of the executable, you can actually type it into the Run dialog box. I'm just going to go get that because it's going to bug me if I don't. Hang on a second.
Well, can I?
Okay, it's part of MMC, so that's going to be really hard. That's going to be kind of hard to do from the Run dialog. Okay, never mind.
What were you going to say, Brian?
I was going to say, while Sean was finding that, I actually had a customer come to me with a hard drive or a problem with one of her Windows drivers being corrupted. She herself said that she had a backup of all her data. Well, when I went in to fix the problem, the backup was not a good backup, and she had a bunch of stuff in QuickBooks that she claimed was all backed up. It wasn't, and it was a blank form, so she ended up having to retype everything in by hand.
Oh no.
Which is unfortunate, but you know what, I'm not sure I'm not exactly sure what I could have done, because she said to me flat out that she had backed everything up, and I made sure of that.
Did we talk about waivers?
Yeah, we did.
Okay.
We did. And if the user has actually said that to you, and then it turns out that they haven't had it backed up, then you can certainly say, look, I'm going on the information you provided me. I always check what sort of backup it is and whether I think it's valid. And if I have the ability to back it up, storage is so cheap, I just have a 1 terabyte external lying around just to back users' data up. And believe me, the number of users that will polish my shoes for the fact that I backed their data up, you wouldn't believe. Like, there was one guy who had a hard drive failing, and the first thing I did was back all his data up onto one of my spare hard drives, and this guy couldn't thank me enough. So it might be a good investment to get yourself like some sort of external drive that you can back the user's data up on temporarily, and then once you've got the repair job done, take it away and do what
wipe
else.
Wipe it, yeah.
Obviously, my imaging drives with GRML, just thought I'd advertise that again, it's a good way to image up users' hard drives.
Yeah, I do the same thing if at all possible. I mean, unless they have sort of 400 gigs of stuff. I always do a backup before I, if possible, before I can do any repairs. And it makes people very happy if you can get stuff back for them.
I'm a bit confused by that comment in chat, actually.
He used it and it works like a bomb. In other words, it works really well.
Oh.
He imaged it up. And version 2.0 of that podcast...
The question mark confused me. Like, he wasn't sure...
The new version of that, we think we're going to turn into a Daisy book. So if anybody would like the Daisy book, we're actually looking at doing an imaging your hard drive Daisy book where you can go forward and go through setup requirements, what you'll need, yada, 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 so you can jump around and find the bits you actually want. So that's going to happen at some point because I think people would like that.
I would love that.
The backup thing
to me is kind of a mystery. I've backed up stuff that I think that I need files and stuff, but I don't have like an image in my drive. You know, if the drive crashed, I'd have to reinstall this, reinstall that, and I think there's a better way of doing it. Backups to me are just a mystery. I need to get that worked out.
I need to actually get a drive devoted to my Mac and run Time Machine, because from what I've heard, it works fairly well.
You really do, Sean. Time Machine rocks
just
your Apple
aside,
world.
Yeah.
And last night, just to tell a quick backup story that we had a happy ending, I had stashed exam diagram descriptions for the final in a particular folder on our server, and we had gone through with one of our ex-students who had said, "What is this weird file?" And we'd all went, "Ah, it's rubbish," and we deleted it, which turned out to be the descriptions for the final. But due to our snapshotted backup system, I went back to last week and with my little backup Time Machine, and I pulled back the file, and everybody was happy. So, backups rock.
Yeah.
If you're using Linux, you owe it to yourself to check out our snapshot. You really do. If it's the one utility I can insist you check out if you're running Linux, our snapshot rocks your backup world. But yeah, we're very happy.
And for I think it was two of the students that were with us when we were doing that. I just have one thing to say. So that's what that file was.
Oh,
aww. We got it back. It's all good. But yeah,
I was going to very quickly say
the point that Brad makes is a good one. Everybody tells you to back up, but nobody actually tells you how to do it.
Yeah,
it's like, you've got to back up all your data or bad things are going to happen and the demons from the seventh plane of hell are going to come and invade your house. How do I back up? Oh, you'll work it out. She'll be right.
Yeah, I backed up like my applications data folder, that has a lot of settings in there and a deck, and then my documents and those sort of things in my QuickBooks and stuff I have pointed into there, and I back that up. But as far as a lot of stuff, I'd be hurting if my drive crashed. I'd be in a scramble to get everything back on there again when I think I can just plop it on from a backup and then good to go. But I just need to know how to get good software.
There are stuff like Zip Backup and stuff. Would anybody be interested in a Friday presentation on backing up your stuff with the tools and tricks that we've found over the years? Would that interest people?
I'll be there.
Yeah.
Yes. That would be.
Okay, look, I realize we don't have any interest in that. No, I'm just being sarcastic. Okay, we'll make that happen. I will actually get RoboCopy and Zip Backup and all my little tools and tricks, and we'll talk about how you can back different things up. We'll have netbooks and external drives and all sorts of good stuff. What's this week? Probably... I'll see how I go. Probably not tomorrow. How about next week?
Well, we weren't expecting it tomorrow. At least I wasn't.
I think I could probably do it tomorrow, actually. Yeah, I could actually do it tomorrow.
That'd be good. Yeah, all right. So 9 o'clock, we'll have a presentation on that instead of study group, unless somebody really needs study time. Does anyone feel that they need any guided study group this week? It's okay if you do, but speak up if anyone wants it.
We'll just start the presentation a bit later. That's okay. That's easy. All right, and I'll go and have a look at Replicated, Dana, because I haven't looked at it. If you've got any other pointers that you want to throw me at, drop me an email, and I'll include them. Otherwise, if you want to be involved, you you can certainly
just
interrupt.
Just record the thing tomorrow night.
Carbonite?
Of course. Carbonite. Yeah, it works.
Or, as the Mac says, Carbonite, which...
Weird. Carbonite is an online backup system, and they'll store as much data as you want them to store, and then when it all blows up, you can either download bits of it from them again, or you can pay, and they'll ship you a hard drive. You pay like $200, and they'll ship all your data on a hard drive. You've got to have a good upload to do that. If you're in Australia and you've only got 256 kilobits up, it's going to take a long time to push 200 gig to Carbonite. So it's certainly a better solution if you're in the States. And if you are metered on uploads, which a lot of people in Australia here are, Carbonite is not your backup solution unless you know exactly what you're backing up and what you're doing. We use Jungle Disk as well. It worked fairly well. But you do have to have a good upstream and one that isn't metered.
And they meter... The problem with them is they meter what you upload and download, unlike Dropbox. Just buy yourself some Dropbox space, guys.
Who meters it?
Jungle Disk.
Dropbox
so,
is...
Jungle Disk actually meters what you upload. You have to pay for the uploads and downloads to it.
Carbonite doesn't. So Carbonite is free.
Yeah,
the other thing
I follow
to watch
them
out
on
with
Twitter,
Dropbox,
and they make their service sound really good. But of
it
course
is good.
They're supposed to.
So is Backblaze. Backblaze is the one that Christopher Toth uses. He reckons they rock as well. Backblaze is another one. The other thing I would point out to people is if you are on a metered plan, be careful what you're doing with Dropbox because it's very easy to chew through your gigs as you're shoveling 200 megs of this album, and that movie backwards and forwards between your friends on Dropbox. So just watch out for that as well.
Once you're in the System Properties dialog for Device Manager, whether you've gotten there with Windows Pause or the My Computer Properties, find the hard or Control Panel system, find the Hardware tab, and click Device Manager. Apparently, it's also possible to put a shortcut to Device Manager on your desktop. Grace, how do you do that? You're the one who put that in here, and I've never figured out how to
do
that. Put Device Manager on your desktop.
Oh, you make a shortcut to devmgr.msc. You find devmgrmsc.exe, and you right-click and go Create Shortcut, and Device Manager turns up on the desktop. That'll do it.
Okay, cool. These icons are important for you to know when working with sighted people in Device Manager. A device that the operating system determines to be acting incorrectly is flagged with an error icon, and this type of error has a yellow circle with an exclamation point in it.
It went bang.
If a device is... Yes, it went bang.
So it's just the way to remember it.
Yeah, that's true. If a device is disabled, it is flagged with a red circle and an X. A yellow question mark, indicates that the hardware is not functioning properly because the system does not know which driver to install for the hardware.
Now, for the red X, you can remember the stop button on all those talking book recorders where the X means stop.
Yes!
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good one. These icons can be read by NVDA. Actually, NVDA doesn't read circle question. It'll say this device is not working properly, or this device is working properly. Why JAWS has not done this, I don't know. WindowEyes can also announce device statuses with the use of an optional third-party script, and it works well.
Couldn't you, those icons, could you label those yourself with JAWS, could you not?
Yeah, you probably could, maybe, if they're actually
You probably
graphics.
Could, but how are you gonna get the icon you want to label? I mean, it's easy enough to disable something, but how do you...
Yeah, it wouldn't be that hard to do.
How do you create the proper
What you do, what you do is you find the device that is working properly, label that one as working properly, then that'll eliminate all the ones that aren't working as properly, then you disable a device and label that, and then you know the one that's left by process elimination is the one that is busted.
The other thing you can do is go into properties, and it will actually tell you, this device is working properly, this device is disabled, this device...
Slower.
We don't even know what this is. Yeah, slower,
just go label
you can
the
do
graphic.
It that way.
That will help you label the
I
graphic.
Just hope
you'll
they
know
are graphics.
Yeah,
I hope they are, because I don't actually
Let's have
know.
A look.
Yeah, they are. I suspect they haven't done it for the same reason that site license auth codes are only distributed in print, but that's political and we won't go there.
All right.
Yeah, there's three graphics, though. There's actually three graphics next to my hard disk, and I'm not sure which one you'd actually label.
Okay. Whoop. I just did something I didn't want to do. I'm coming up to the point, Carrie, that we've prepared sounds for, so I'm just going to try and get that going.
Is there something I should talk about while you're doing that, or something Grace can talk about that? Because we're going to play you something, everyone. It's going to be exciting.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we're going to talk about beep codes. Beep codes occur when the... Sorry, I'm just adapting to the delay that suddenly happened in my ears. Remember that you can use B-codes to help you in troubleshooting as well. Each BIOS has different beep codes, so check the manual or the website. Or YouTube. YouTube has an amazing amount of information, and so does Wikipedia if you look up POST. I was doing this morning when I had a free moment, and you can find all kinds of stuff. People have actually compiled lists, AMI codes, Intel codes, and so on. If you hear one long and three short beeps, this means that no monitor is detected. This is Morse code for the letter B, meaning blank screen, and is common to all video card BIOSes. So if a BIOS has a video card, or a video card has a BIOS. Now, if Carrie could provide some fluff while I get this ready.
Tons
that
of
would
fluff.
Anybody
Any?
Be interested yes. in a virtual audio cable demo? That can be another one we can do. We'll do a demo on virtual
totally.
Audio cable and how to make it work. It obviously goes without saying that you will pay the Russian $25 for your copy of virtual audio cable, which is probably a good thing to do. And I'm also providing fluff, which is like the stuff I get out of the dryer and store in a little container for my emergency survival kit. We right to go? Okay.
Let me just find my studio recorder. All right. So here is what your code sounds like as found on YouTube. There you go. Wasn't that exciting?
Hear
it.
Or did it not?
Yeah, that was awesome.
Okay. Let's do this.
It was very silent.
Oh, I need to actually... Yeah. I know why.
Computer work.
You need to change the input on Ventrilo under setup for the virtual cable one.
Oh, I did that. I forgot to do it in studio recorder. Here we go.
Oops.
Oh, audio.
There we go.
All right. How about that? Yeah, that went.
It just crackled for me.
I'll run it again, Sean.
Oh, it did. It didn't go.
No, we heard it.
All right.
Yeah, we heard
it. Run it from again.
Let me do this again. Let's see. I don't think it's actually keying.
It
didn't.
The first time it did.
And now I looped.
Yeah, it went twice.
There we go.
That was because control space is loop.
Okay, so while Sean switches himself back, we will talk about the values of connecting the PC speaker. I actually had somebody who I was working with an ISP for back in 1997 or so, and they said, I can't be bothered connecting the PC speaker, it's pointless. And he spent an hour debugging his computer and it wouldn't come up and the server wouldn't work and he began to swear and swear and swear and swear, and I said, will you please connect the PC speaker? And he's like, oh, all right. And he connected the PC speaker and it went beep, beep. And I said, okay, turn it off, reset the memory. And you don't want to hear what he said after that, but effectively we got the machine fixed, and it was a very handy thing to have happen. And he always took my word on hardware after that and made sure he connected the PC speaker where it existed.
All right, am I back?
Yeah.
All right, good. If the computer stops booting after POST, check the BIOS to see if all devices are detected and to check that the BIOS is configured properly. You'll need sighted help for this, as the BIOS is all before the system has really had a chance to do anything else. The article on Post also mentions other things that have power on self-tests, which I don't remember exactly what they were, but certainly things I wouldn't think would have them. You can use diagnostic software to diagnose hardware problems. For example, hard drive diagnostic software, which you researched in Chapter 2, can help you to troubleshoot hard drive problems. Remember, if the tool is used before the computer boots into Windows, it is not accessible. And some of these tools do run from floppies and such, or even bootable media in the command prompt. So unless you are old and have, or well, not old, but unless you have older technology, you have ASAP and the stuff to make that go, or another DOS screen reader, you're going to have a bit of a tough time.
Just a handy hint, if you guys want to test your memory, you can actually compile up a version of Memtest 86. Yeah, I can see you all running off to fire up the C compiler right now, so I'll compile one up and stick it on QCAT. You can actually compile a version of Memtest that boots off a floppy that will beep when it finds memory errors. So if you have a working PC speaker and you put this disk in and it beeps at you, you've got memory problems. That's after the post beeps, of course.
One of the ways to tell if you have a working speaker, PC speaker, is to turn on toggle keys in accessibility and see where the beep comes from, or if the beep even happens at all.
Be warned, some people with Intel sound cards and stuff, you will not actually get the beeps out of your computer until the sound cards and stuff are up and initialized under Windows, because the Intel cards actually emulate the PC speaker beep, just to throw another wrinkle in the beep thing.
Yeah, there's a couple that do that.
Hey Sean, can
some of the older Sigmatels do that. Yeah.
There is a couple of instances where you actually will not have beep codes. And I actually ran into it on my older computer that I was ripping apart for Chapter 3. I pulled all the memory out of it, and it didn't yell at me, but it didn't boot either, so...
Yeah, you had actually mentioned that to me earlier, and I forgot, so I'm glad you brought it up.
There's actually I actually had an interesting Asus BIOS, and it actually has a thing where you connect up speakers to the sound card. And we'd forgotten to plug in one of the auxiliary power connectors into the CPU, and we turned it on, and this very loud American voice went, "System failed, CPU check! System failed, CPU check!"
Oh, wow.
And we're just like, oh, okay. And then when we, plugged the cable in, it went, "Post complete, continuing normal boot." And we're just like, oh, good on ya. Now, how do we turn that off?
Yeah, my friends used to do it every time it booted. It would say, "Computer system passed power on self-test, now loading the operating system." And I thought, that is cool. You'd get used to it if it was your own computer after a while, I think.
You can actually customize all the messages.
Yep.
Have fun with
cool.
That, Drew.
Yeah. Do you have a board that does that?
No, yeah, just winding him up.
The board CD had an audio editor, little audio editor program that you could reprogram all the WAV files to whatever you wanted. And
you can make JAWS do it.
Oh, who wants eloquence in everything?
I don't know why I went there. It's all right.
It's fast. It works.
Now that
I'm talking about BIOS beeps, though.
Oh.
Yeah.
That wouldn't be helpful to the average sighted person. I think the loud American would be better, but, you know.
Well, that's why I'd record you for it. It'd work just great. You'd always...
Jeez.
Well, that's a compliment. You wouldn't miss it, would you?
No.
That's
for sure.
The most backhanded compliment ever.
Oh, well, you get that.
Yeah.
Now that, if we're ready to move on, now that we have identified what the problem is, we're going to go to the second step of the troubleshooting process, which is to establish a theory of probable causes. So we're going to create a list of reasons why the issue may be occurring. List the most simple and obvious solutions at the top and the complex ones at the bottom of your list. That's how we come up with a list of probable causes. The next step in the troubleshooting process, the third step, is to determine the exact cause of the problem. To do this, test each theory on your list from the simplest to the most complex, until you find the cause of your problem. This process may seem slow at first, but with experience you will gain speed. If you have tested all theories and none of them are the cause, go back to step 2 and establish a new theory, so make a new list. If you are unable to determine the cause, you can escalate the problem to a technician with more experience if that option is available to you. Before you escalate the problem, document the problem, all information you have gained from the customer, any tests performed, and their results. This helps the new technician because they do not have to waste their time trying solutions that you have already ruled out. And that's good because you want to make their lives easier because you've handed something to them that you don't feel equipped to deal with. So you should make it easier as part of your doing that. The fourth step of the troubleshooting process is to implement the solution. If one of the quick solutions you tried earlier has fixed the issue, you can move on to step 5, which is to verify the solution and the full system functionality. Once you have figured out the exact cause of the problem, it is time to implement the solution. You may need to do additional research to find your solution. Can anyone tell me places that you would go to get to research more if you were having a problem? So would somebody like to name one?
Wikipedia.
I use the internet, like Tom's Hardware, Wikipedia, all kinds of forums. Forums are
I've
my
never
best
heard
friend.
Of Tom's Hardware. That's cool.
Oh, yep. Yeah, no, that's a really good site.
It is full of ads and stuff, though, so AdBlock Plus is your friend.
Okay, what are some other ones?
Another good site is ehow.com.
Oh, that is good, actually.
Yeah, eHow is cool.
You've got to be careful with eHow. eHow is an excellent site, but make sure the actual things that you're reading have actually been positively reviewed, because it is a user contrib site, and I'd say 99.99998% of the stuff is good, but you might get one lemon. So if something sets off the alarm bells, just run the common sense filter through it as well.
What I'd have That's to not recommend is the Experts Exchange, because they will make you pay for it. So anything from Experts Exchange, you are probably not going to find what you are looking for, unless you are going to pay a lot of money to join there.
Is this replicator thing, just while we're on it, is that called Karen's Replicator, Dina? Thank you. It'll be in tomorrow's presentation.
That's a lovely little utility. I had one yesterday where somebody had malware that was very fun to kill. I actually did. Thank you, Viper command line scanner. There's my shameless plug. but one of the neat things it did was unassociated exe files with anything. So anytime you tried to run an exe file, which is every program on your computer for the most part, it said, what do you want to open this with? which was great fun, and I poked about and I found all kinds of solutions, and here's where experience helps. I mean, there were people proposing registry hacks, like implement these changes, and I read very carefully before I implement somebody's pre-made reg file to see what it does. These forums and public posting sites are great, but you have to be a bit careful about the advice that you get.
Anyone see that one where they were saying to get rid of this virus, delete /Windows/ some unusual executable name? And I can't count the number of people that just went in and smashed it.
Oh.
Yep, I remember teachers at school doing it.
One of the things is, guys, if it says delete /Windows/something or /programfiles/something, those are two directories that you'd better know what you're deleting, because they are system critical folders. That's why they're hidden by default, because usual users shouldn't be messing around in there. If somebody says unhide this directory and then smash these two files out of program files, be sure you know what you're doing, because when it breaks, you keep multiple pieces.
Okay, so some of the answers that the curriculum proposes are help desk repair logs, other technicians, manufacturer FAQs, technical websites, news groups, computer manuals and device manuals, online forums, and internet search. So those are some of the places that you might look. When implementing your solutions, try one at a time, starting from the simplest and least destructive. If a solution does not work, reverse it and try the next one. That reversing it is important, guys. Sometimes breaking a large problem into smaller problems makes troubleshooting more manageable. Solve each of the small problems independently and then move on to the next one.
Oh, if I had a dollar for every technician that said, oh, you just reformat and reinstall, and that's the solution to every problem they've ever done. It's like,
we'd be rolling.
Whoa. Oh, believe me, I was.
Yeah.
People would just go, I'm just going to reformat and reinstall. That'll fix everything. Until this guy had actually reformatted and reinstalled 6 times in a 6-week period, and he still was getting his blue screens. And I said, you know what, Mark, maybe it's time that we look at a different solution.
What do they say? Insanity is trying the same thing over and over and over again, and it not working, and you keep trying. I don't know if that's true or not, but it sure seems like it sometimes. Step 5 is to verify the solution in full system functionality. In this step, verify that the problem is fixed, and that you have not created any additional problems while fixing the original one. If possible, have the customer verify that the problem is fixed and the computer is working properly. This is also the time to apply any preventative maintenance tasks or measures to avoid the issue in future, if you can. Finally, the last step of the troubleshooting process is not one to be overlooked. It is to document your findings. If possible, verbally tell the customer the problem and solution, as well as including this information in all work orders that you do, if you think the customer will be able to kind of get it. If not, you may just want to, you know, note it down somewhere and possibly give it to them so that if they need someone more knowledgeable to help them interpret it. But some people just don't, it's not going to make sense to them, so you might want to, you know, think about that a bit. Have the customer try to produce the problem to show that it is fixed. The following information should be contained in your technician's journal for later reference. Description of the problem, all solutions that did not work, the solutions that did work, and any parts needed to complete the repair. In the work order, you will need the description of the problem, steps taken to solve the problem, any components used to solve the problem, and the time you worked on the problem. You know, how long did it take you? What did it involve? This will be available to you at the end of this process that we just talked about, that we've just gone through, will be available to you at the end of every chapter from now on. I think that's about it. Let me just keep going. Yep, that's actually all that I have, except we have a quiz. Would we like to go ahead and do that now?
We would. We've got 17 minutes. We're going to do it, and then we can get onto Module 5 and catch up. Any questions, guys?
Yeah.
This
I will take the
sound scheme is bizarre.
Silence is a no. Which one?
The sound scheme you dropped in my the Yufakaru tweet scheme is bizarre.
Yeah, I like that sound scheme.
The only one I don't like is the new tweet sound, and that's the one I always. But all the other, some of these I'm not sure where he pulled them from. Maybe they're ones in the pack in the application that I just haven't heard yet. But yeah, most of them I really like, except for the new tweets. That one bugs me.
I just saw something totally fascinating from Windows Secrets about IPv6 and 4 and stuff. So if you guys have Windows Secrets, you should totally read this article. It is fascinating. Seriously.
Is it in the free newsletter?
Yeah, it's the top story. And it's a really good layman's IPv6 information. It's so interesting to me.
That sounds cool.
So what I'll do is I will repost a link to that article to the mailing list later today. So if you don't have Windows Secrets and you can't find it, you will find
Yay.
It. Guys, if you do have $10 spare a year, apart from all of the money that you're going to donate to Cavi, just thought I'd try that, I would strongly recommend you subscribe to Windows Secrets. It's one of the better informative newsletters that you can subscribe to for $10-$20 a year, and it really is jam-packed full of useful information. I think Mr. Moore is subscribed to Windows Secrets, if my memory serves me. Are you? I think you said you were.
Since the Langlist days in 96, and I paid for the Plus because there's really good content in there.
All right, so we're going to do the quiz just like Grace did the other one. So here we go with number one.
What was that?
Which? What?
There was this doo-doo-doo-dunk. I'm just like, that is a really good intro to the quiz.
Oh, that's a reply. That's a reply. That's a reply.
Are you still routed through the cable or something?
No, I'm not.
I didn't hear it. I think that was your reply sound.
It's a bit scary the first time, isn't it?
It is. I sort of thought that was a really... It sort of went doo-doo-doo-dung, and it was perfectly for let's get started on the quiz. And I'm like, that is so cool. But unfortunately, it's not on the recording.
That's hilarious.
You could make that happen. You could drop that in.
I will.
Yes! Yes!
Sweet. Okay. Let's do this
quiz
thing.
Back to... Yes. Number one, which three common tasks are performed during preventive maintenance? So we're going to choose three. A, check and secure loose cables. Answer now. Absolutely. We do check and secure for loose cables. That's a yes. How about B, update the RAM? Yeah, we don't need to do that all the time. C, clean the mouse and the keyboard. Yes, we do clean the mouse and keyboard. Sorry, I think there's some delay.
Dana's delay.
Or something. Okay, that's fine.
It's okay.
D.
Well, he's personally not delayed. His computer is.
Yeah. How about update the drivers? I don't tend to like it, but that's what they've got, and it's certainly better than the other two choices, which are reinstall the operating system or install additional peripherals. So we've got our three.
Updating drivers can be preventative maintenance because it can help for things not to go bad, and it can fix bugs or get you ready for a service pack, which is preventative maintenance.
We also found that when standby and stuff was dying, there was a problem. I just gotta talk to a student, so continue on, peeps.
Alright. Number two. In which two situations is it recommended to ask the customer to sign a liability release form before attempting any kind of repair? We're going to choose two. Is it A, the technician needs to share their responsibility with the customer? That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
B, the information on the computer is critical. The actual answer is no.
I agree. I disagree with them, though. I'd say,
Yep.
It is a weird question, and I'd say abso-friggin-lutely. But that's not the right answer. No.
Yeah,
listen to the rest of the answers, and you'll understand why not.
Okay, so we know that's no. How about the technician is unable to back up the customer's information? The customer information. How about... That's correct. That's absolutely right. How about D? The information in the backup is confidential. Again, the answer is no.
Yeah, that's completely ridiculous. It should be yes, but it's no.
I think they're assuming that the customer is already aware of whether... They're talking about when should you have the customer sign a form. That's...
If I'm working with confidential information...
In this case, you should sign a form. I agree to keep this confidential and not share it, blah, blah, blah. The customer shouldn't... I mean, you should probably both sign it, but to make it valid, but...
Interestingly
enough... This isn't
enough,
a sort of liability disclaimer.
We had a bit of an issue in Canada, in BC. We had a thing in BC where our medical records are stored by a company in Texas, I believe. And when the Patriot Act came into force, a lot of people were jumping up and down and saying, well, hold on a second. If they have to give all their info to the American government, that means all of our medical records are liable to be given to the American government and aren't confidential. And there was a big deal with that. I'm not sure if anything got resolved, but a lot of people were worried.
All right. The E is the customer is unable to provide a backup. Absolutely. So that is one of the answers they're looking for. And the other answer that they are looking for is, let me find it again. I lost it. I'm sorry. The other one is the technician is unable to back up the customer information. So if they don't have one and you can't make one, that's what they're saying. Really, all of these are
logical. Everything except A is logical. You need to get the forms out. I would, at least.
Okay, 3. Which type of question? You know what? I skipped something, and I apologize. We need to actually talk about this one before. How did I skip this? Oh my goodness. In step 1, and this is my fault for not preparing as well as I should have. In step 1, there are types of questions that you need to ask the customer. And they are open-ended questions and closed-ended questions. So, open-ended questions allow the customer to explain the problem in their own words and give you a whole bunch of information at once. Whereas closed-ended questions are usually need just a yes-no answer. Okay, so with that in mind, should I give some examples or just go through this question, Grace? I feel like a complete idiot, and I apologize.
Did I not write that up for you?
Nope. It's not here.
Oh. Well, I guess I've given this chapter so many times that I didn't do it.
Yeah, I'm so sorry, and I should have thought of it. Do you want to fix that?
That's
or
okay.
Am
Grace
I,
will be
good.
You want
me to fix that?
Which one of you is fixing it?
They're his
I
notes.
Think Grace should fix it. I think Grace should fix it. No, I'm just kidding. I'll
children,
do
children.
All right, I'll do it. All right. So, which type of question allows the customer to completely describe the problem? Is it A, closed-ended, B, open-ended, C, specific, or D, technical? I thought they were going to actually give examples, but... Yes, it's open-ended. Who wants to think of and brainstorm really quickly some open-ended questions that you might ask a customer about a problem they're having?
What happens when you what boot you up? Is there any strange noises? No.
Yeah, the two of those. What happens
okay,
when you boot
yeah.
up? Can
what
you explain
exactly were you doing when the problem happened?
Yes, yeah, so what were you doing when the problem occurred is a great one.
Absolutely. That's one of the first ones you want to ask.
Yeah, that's really the first one. What was going on?
Well, I always start with a more basic one than that. I start with sort of describe in your terminology, whatever you like, at the very beginning, what your issue is. Why are you calling me?
Yeah.
Why am I here?
Yeah, what is the problem as you see it? Yeah, that's... I mean, you might not phrase it the way I just did, but yeah, that's a good one. Whereas closed-ended questions would be like, has anyone else used your computer recently? Or was there anything new installed recently? That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Describe what is
the
problem and tell me what you expect. Yeah, that's a good one too.
It's just worded it a little differently than we would
what,
say.
What result
what you
are you... Yeah,
might be
what
you
result...
need to come over and fix their problem.
No,
well,
what
yeah,
would you expect to happen? What is the expected behavior of this computer is what he's getting at.
Yeah, that's what he wants. Wow, that was a complete facepalm about the other thing, guys. Okay. Anyway, 4. Which Windows application can be used to obtain detailed information about errors that have occurred in the system? Is it A, BIOS settings, B, device manager, C, event viewer, D, security manager? Answer now.
I'll be
right. Yes, C, event viewer is the correct answer. Device manager refers to actual hardware dealing with the computer, whereas Event Viewer tracks what kinds of events and errors or bits of information get logged. 5. A newly installed hard drive is not working. Where should the technician look to see if the drive is recognized by the system? Is it A, BIOS, B, boot sector, C, event viewer, or D, partition table? Answer now. Yes, the answer is the BIOS. Very good. That is the end of the quiz that I have for you guys. So, if there are any other, if there are not any other questions, we can knock off for the day.
Any other pending questions? I posted on the mailing list last night asking if people were going to be interested in the podcast. That is going to happen, so if you want to be on the beta test list and possibly fill your player up with bits of podcast, drop instructors a line and we'll put you on the beta test before we set the thing live.
I'm hoping that program that we found for you will help you tag, at least tag, maybe not the podcasts like as a podcast, but at least some of the other information, like who the lecturer is and so on.
Oh, it'll let me do the album tags and stuff. It's all good. I've already figured out how I'm going to handle that.
Okay.
And I have a Samba share into the web server, so we will get that sorted.
Fantastic. All right, I apologize, guys, for forgetting that piece. Yeah.
But, that's no big deal.
You know, I haven't been doing.
Obviously, if you'd all read your notes, you would have.
Yes, actually, pre-reading is good. Pre-reading is very good because and I'll just. Yeah, I feel a little better. One of the just a reminder, guys, that you know you do want to read the notes. These lectures are supplementary. There have been students in the past who took the course for 5 or 6 months or so, and then said, "Oh, notes? What are you talking about? Where are these notes?" And I think Carrie and his co-lecturer were just a bit amazed and astounded that, you know, that they'd been mentioning the notes over and over again and nobody had asked where they could be gotten hold of. So
I should have actually come up with a promo that sort of went www.qcat.org, student resources.
Well, you know, Carrie, the first episode... They didn't have one then, at that time.
Are you looking for your last notes?
Now, here's something else to think about, Carrie. The very first episode in a podcast, iTunes considers it a promo. So we could have a play with that, okay. Actually, or something there. We could have a play with that if we really wanted to.
I just need some sound effects from somewhere. Drew, you have a mission. if you could.
Drew is probably going to have them.
Oh, just ones that go...
Yeah, I'm sure. So no, you do the voice for me, and I could totally put together a promo, I'm sure.
Okay, no worries. All right.
We could get some music beds and
so
everything.
If anybody doesn't know where the notes are, please speak up now, okay? Please, has everybody seen the notes for ITU1?